Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
Remaining silent and ignoring the lie emboldens the liar. I will not participate in that. I will not sit back and watch in silence while others lead our party down a path that abandons the rule of law and joins the former president's crusade to undermine our democracy.
When Republican Representative Liz Cheney came to the House floor to make that speech yesterday evening, her Republican colleagues could not even make the pretense of the respect and decorum you'd expect of a healthy democracy. They simply left. Almost every single Republican member cleared the House chamber. They would not even listen to her defense of American democracy. Well, Jack Beatty, what does it mean when an entire party seemingly covers their eyes and ears to the truth, Jack?
Well, it's a bad sign for democracy. It's a portent. In his letters, Kierkegaard has a sentence. He says, a question, how can I be myself in the presence of the truth? The Republicans in Congress and Republican voters at large have decided they can't be themselves in the presence of the truth. The truth that Joe Biden legitimately won the election. The truth that Donald Trump incited an insurrection against the Capitol. The truth that the policies they espouse are not majoritarian. They can't face the truth that they represent a diminishing demographically pool of the American public, that every year the country becomes more diverse. These are the truths they can't be themselves in the presence of. And so they assert identity against reason and fact and evidence. And where does that point to? Nihilism toward whatever the dictator, toward perhaps even dictatorship, certainly toward some kind of authoritarian rule. And polls, what's really frightening is that survey research indicates there's a strong appetite among Republicans even for violence to preserve what they call the American way of life. We had Larry Bartels on our program last year, the political scientist. His research found that about half of Republicans were willing to think about violence to, quote, defend the American way of life as we have known it. We're in a dangerous position.
Well, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's Jack Beatty, our news analyst. And this is On Point. And today, we are going to talk about where the Republican Party is headed and, by extension, where this nation is headed. Representative Cheney has been removed as House Republican chair via a voice vote, simply, as Jack noted, for speaking out against former President Donald Trump's embrace and amplification of lies about the integrity of America's electoral system. So we want to know what you think, especially if you are a registered Republican or if you voted for Donald Trump in the 2020 election. Do you believe in the strength and integrity of American democracy? Do you believe it's worth preserving? Do you believe in the truth of the outcome of the 2020 election? Find us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. Well, along with Jack, today I'd like to introduce Cass Mudda, professor of public affairs at the University of Georgia, Athens, and author of The Far Right Today. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Pippa Norris also joins us. She's professor of comparative politics at Harvard University and founder of the Electoral Integrity Project, which monitors elections around the world. She's also author most recently of Cultural Backlash, Trump, Brexit, and Populist Authoritarianism. Pippa Norris, welcome to you.
A pleasure to be with you, Meghna.
So, Pippa, let me start with you. What does this particular moment, the ousting of Representative Cheney from a House GOP leadership position, what does it symbolize to you?
So, as Jack says, it really is a major threat to American liberal democracy. Essentially, parties have always been divided on public policy, and that's fine. That's democracy. You should bargain and compromise and talk about different issues and take different stances. The problem is if you dispute the rules of the game, if you don't accept the outcome of an election or the integrity of the president. And clearly, this is something which we've had in the past, challenges to American democracy. This is not new. Think about extremist movements of the 1950s, whether they're about race and the Ku Klux Klan, whether about issues of conspiratorial thinking and conspiracies and communist threats. So it's not brand new, but never before, I think, have we had a major party in a two-party system like we have right now challenge liberal democracy and the basic principles of an election outcome, which every judge, every court decision has certified as being valid and fair and accurate.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more of what Representative Cheney said last night in her House floor speech, specifically about that big lie regarding the 2020 election. She once again had to go through what the truth is, and here's what she said.
The Electoral College has voted. More than 60 state and federal courts, including multiple judges the former president appointed, have rejected his claims. The Trump Department of Justice investigated the former president's claims of widespread fraud and found no evidence to support them. The election is over. That is the rule of law. That is our constitutional process. Those who refuse to accept the rulings of our courts are at war with the Constitution. Our duty is clear. Every one of us who has sworn the oath must act to prevent the unraveling of our democracy.
Cass Mutta, when Liz Cheney says those who refuse to accept the rulings of the courts are at war with the Constitution, as Jack said earlier, something like 70% of Republicans, according to recent polling, don't believe in the outcome of the election. Are we talking about 70% of American Republicans are at war with the Constitution?
Yeah, that is difficult to say factually, yes, because the Constitution lays out that the Electoral College decides on this, and then courts decide on this as well. And so by pretty much ignoring that or even going against that, they go against the Constitution. At the same time, if you would say to most of them, you're at war with the Constitution, I'm pretty certain that they don't recognize themselves in this, because they think that they are defending the Constitution, they're defending U.S. democracy, and they're defending the American way of life, because they think that there was widespread fraud.
Well, Jack, I want to turn back to you here. But first, let's hear another moment from Liz Cheney's speech where she summarized what she sees as the threat to American democracy.
Today, we face a threat America has never seen before. A former president who provoked a violent attack on this Capitol in an effort to steal the election has resumed his aggressive effort to convince Americans that the election was stolen from him. He risks inciting further violence. Millions of Americans have been misled by the former president. They have heard only his words, but not the truth, as he continues to undermine our democratic process, sowing seeds of doubt about whether democracy really works at all. I am a conservative Republican, and the most conservative of conservative principles is reverence for the rule of law.
Now, Jack, former Senator Jeff Flake just wrote an op-ed in The Washington Post where he says that the contemporary Republican Party is a party where the greatest offense is honesty. Now, how tenable is a democratic system if that is true about one of the two major parties?
Well, it means that there's a foundation of irrationality there, right? When we depart from the truth, some objectively shared reality, we're in a world of shadows and illusions and mass delusion. It's as if the party is now defined not by its shared belief, but by shared delusions. This cult of personality business, this just couldn't be less American. It's something you see in, well, we saw in Europe in the with the Führer cult. It's something that Nikita Khrushchev exposed in his secret speech, the Stalin cult of personality. It's something we've seen in Latin America with Perón and others. It's not something we have ever seen here before. As a central sort of armature of a major political party. Nothing like this.
Jack, I'm really grateful that you brought up those international examples, because that's one of the primary reasons why we invited Cass and Pippa on the show today, because we want to, you know, really ground this in lessons to be learned from directions that other nations have gone in the past when faced with, I guess, if not similar, analogous challenges to the acceptance of reality by political leadership. So, I mean, Pippa, are there places that you would look to as examples of what might happen here in the United States, international examples?
So the world has been going through something of a democratic recession, essentially, ever since about 2005, 2006, all of the monitoring agencies have been looking at the state of democracy around the world, and they produce annual reports. And to give you, for example, The Economist, they produce a democracy index based on things like participation, civil liberties. And what they found was that in 2020, about 116 countries out of 167 have declined in levels of democracy. The United States ranks 25th worldwide, which is not particularly good. And you can look at some other studies. For example, my own study, the Electoral Integrity Project, looks at the quality of elections since 2012. And what we find is that, unfortunately, the United States ranks second to last in terms of the quality of the electoral system and the way that the elections are working and electoral integrity. So many countries around the world have seen this decline. America is not unique. And therefore, you can't simply say it's about Trump or even the Republican Party. It's a much broader phenomenon.
Right. Well, we've got to take a quick break here, Pippa. So I want to pick up that thought when we come back. Pippa Norris, Cass Mudah, and Jack Beattie, stand by. We're talking about where the Republican Party is headed, and by extension, where this country is headed. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're talking about where the Republican Party is headed, and by extension, where this country is headed after Representative Liz Cheney was voted out via voice vote from her leadership position in the House GOP. I'm joined today by Pippa Norris, Cass Mudah, and Jack Beattie, and we're getting a lot of comments online here. Tenna Cook on Facebook says, I'm a registered Republican in Western Nebraska. I did not vote for Trump in 2016 or 2020. He does not stand for GOP principles. He's a chameleon who changed his spots to get elected, morally reprehensible and openly racist by trying to build a wall instead of reform immigration. Tana Cook goes on and says, I have to stay registered as a Republican to vote in local races. In my heart, as a former resident of Wyoming, I am grieving today. Liz is right. The GOP has sadly become a cult of personality. Okay, so we're going to come back to something that Tana said in just a second. But Pippa Norris, just so I don't forget, before the break, you had said that when it comes to electoral integrity, and I hope I'm not paraphrasing that incorrectly, that on your election scale or analysis, the U.S. ranks pretty low. Can you please just explain more in detail what you mean about that?
So electoral integrity is obviously fundamental to liberal democracy. If you don't have competitive elections, if you don't have a level playing field, then other aspects of the system can't work. And the problem in America has been, number one, state laws are essentially regulating the election. And so where a particular party on either side controls the state house, they can start to manipulate the law in order to favor their own party. In many other places, you'll have an electoral commission, which is more national, which sets certain standards on things like hours in which it's open or days in which you can vote and voter registration. Second problem is money. And of course, money has always been an issue in America in terms of election campaigns being so expensive. But really, dark money has flooded the system. And the Federal Election Commission has been really pretty stymied. They've been gridlocked through party control. And that needs a major reform. And then lastly, of course, there's the media. And again, if we go back to, say, the 60s and 70s, with legacy media, network news, you've got a kind of balance and people had diverse views. And now with media bubbles, we see increasingly that people are only getting their information or misinformation from one side or another. And that's a problem which has obviously got worse just in the last 10 years or so. Mm. So those are the three weaknesses of American elections, which have been there for a long time, but I think have got worse under the pressures of party polarization and cultural polarization.
Cass, did you want to comment on that?
Well, I would like to go back to the lessons from abroad issue, because I think what is common is that we go back to the 1930s, and I don't think that's the right historical context or comparative context. I see a lot of similarities to Hungary, where in 2002, Viktor Orban, the then seen as conservative prime minister, lost the elections to his own surprise and pretty much didn't recognize that loss, and even said in again, very similar type of statement, he said, the nation cannot be in opposition. And he responded to that by building pretty much a state within the state around his own organization, which also included a violent period when a video came out that the previous or still current prime minister had lied to get reelected, led to a lot of fighting, the attack of the national TV station, for example, the building. And then they came back to power and in 2010, and since they have pretty much through legal, through nomically democratic ways, completely undermined democracy. And I think that is something that we see at the moment much more, not as smart and clever and homogenous as Orban did in Hungary, but the voter suppression laws, the recounts, the trying to get full control over electoral committees. That is the type of democratic erosion that we see today, which is different from the kind of coup-like attempts of previous periods.
Is it possible to stop that erosion, though? Because what you're talking about is a series of lies upon lies, which have been then, in a sense, given the glean of authenticity through lawsuits, recounts, etc., like you said, which ultimately lead in, as far as I can tell, one direction, which is a massive percentage of voters in this country will likely even just the next election, which is around the corner, will not believe the outcome of the election unless their candidate wins.
Yes, that is true. On the other hand, this is a minority of the population and of the electorate. Both are very important points. which is very disturbing, but it's something else than when the majority thinks this, which to a certain extent is where Hungary was or still is. So I think it is a huge threat, particularly because studies show that there is a growing tolerance towards violence, not necessarily by themselves, but by others in the name of their cause. But it is important that at the same time, there is still a relatively large majority of people that do support like the rule of law, that do accept the elections being fair. And I don't want to minimize it, but I also don't want to be too alarmist.
Mm. Jack Beattie, do you think we're being too alarmist here?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a shift of 45,000 votes in three states would have made Trump the president. That's pretty close. Now, he hadn't repudiated democracy explicitly to that point. That only happened after the election. But wait a minute. I saw one of those debates, both in 2016 and in 2020, where he said, oh, no, I won't accept the results unless I win. No one had ever said anything like that. He was putting the voters on notice. I am not going to abide by the result of this election unless I win. 73 million Americans said that's okay with us. I don't know. Is it alarmist to think that there's a sort of bacillus of extremism out there infecting many, many millions of Americans, driven by all sorts of things, including, as Larry Bartels in his important paper points out, ethnic antagonism. He found that what's driving this taste even for violence among Republicans is less fealty to Trump than a ethnic resentment. The feeling that black people and Hispanics and immigrants are taking things that should go to, quote, real Americans, and that sort of status anxiety is the driving force even behind the cult of personality.
Mm. Well, Jack, actually, to the point you just made, listener Aaron Palicki says someone needs to define what's meant when people say the American way of life. What's meant specifically? What are they claiming to protect? I think you just answered that question.
Yes, they want to maintain their position at the top of the totem pole. And it's Richard Hofstadter looked at this in the 1950s, this status politics where people feel threatened in their position in the hierarchy of peoples, and that suddenly this thing of white identity, which I didn't even know existed, has become a real force.
Mm. Well, Pippa Norris, I want to focus once again on what key people in the Republican Party are saying about what they feel their party stands for right now. So, first of all, here is a clip from representatives, where you'll hear Representative Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene. Gaetz was at a retirement community in Florida holding a Trump rally without Donald Trump. And in this clip, you'll hear him talk with Green by his side.
If Adam Kinzinger wants to be the front man for the establishment to bring our party back to the days of Mitt Romney and John Kasich, and you know what? I'm not going back. This is Donald Trump's party, and I'm a Donald Trump Republican.
Yeah.
You know, Pippa Norris, I heard what you said earlier about the systemic issues regarding the health of American democracy overall. And it's important for us to keep those in mind. And yet I keep coming back to moments like this as well. And it seems as if we cannot ignore the cult of personality now that at least, you know, a critical mass of Republicans have formed around Donald Trump.
Absolutely. But the reason I think is, why is that? What's going on? How do we explain this? After all, you'd have thought any rational party which looks at the record in presidential elections would suggest that they should move back towards the middle, towards the moderates, towards the independents who might come towards them. After all, Republicans, when we look, for example, in the Gallup polls, are about 25% of the electorate. And even if you say, well, let's take conservatives, that's still only 40%. And to win the White House, you obviously need a majority of the popular vote distributed across the Electoral College. So why are they not shifting? Why are they tying their fortunes to a failed candidate who lost by 3 million votes in 2016, who lost by 7 million votes in 2020? And I think that there's a number of reasons. One is simply inertia. In other words, the politicians, the incumbents, got elected in the last few elections through particular districts where the seats are gerrymandered, so they're safe. And so they know that they can get re-elected through this appeal. Secondly, the grassroots of the Republican Party has really become, with one voice, Trumpist or the MAGA groups. And they're essentially authoritarian in their values. They want conformity to their group. And that's why they're rejecting Liz Cheney and others like Romney, who got booed as well. They want loyalty and they feel under threat. And so they're kind of closing ranks. And they have, I disagree a little bit with Jack. It is about ethnic resentment, but it's broader than that. It's, for example, also values which are anti-LGBTQ rights. Think about those laws which are going on about transgender athletics. It's also about religion and the importance of Christianity versus secular values, which have been expanding. It's about nativism. It's about Americans versus others, whoever the others are, us and them politics. So this has kind of taken over. And in particular, that's the thing which is dominating, which is driving the Republican base, even though electorally, we have to remember that the Republicans lost the majority of the popular vote in 7 out of the 8 last presidential elections. And they haven't had a landslide since Reagan.
Mm. Well, and yet very key members of the Republican Party, folks in the Senate, say that they cannot win without continuing down this path. I mean, let's just listen to a moment from Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who was on Fox News just last week. Here's what he had to say.
I would just say to my Republican colleagues, can we move forward without President Trump? The answer is no. I've always liked Liz Cheney, but she's made a determination that the Republican Party can't grow with President Trump. I've determined we can't grow without him.
Cass Mutter, what do you think about that? I mean, Lindsey Graham is asserting something quite remarkable, that the party cannot even grow without Donald Trump, without the very things that, the very strains that Pippa Norris was just talking about.
Yeah, and I think the important point that Pippa made is that in the U.S., particularly in the House, like so many seats, because of gerrymandering, are so safe that the real election for people there is only the primary within their own party. Like, if you win your seat in the primary, you will win it in the election because it is a Republican seat. And as a consequence, like, the primary voter has enormous power. And at this point in time, the primary voter is the Trump voter. This is the most mobilized part of the base. The problem, and in that I think that Lindsey Graham is wrong, is that while this works within the own base, the broader Republican base, it doesn't apply to the broader population. And so while they need to win the primary, they need to do that with a strategy that could lose them then the election, particularly in the Senate.
So, but just out of fairness, how different is that regarding primary voters to what we see in Democratic primaries as well?
No, it is the same mechanism. And as a consequence, what you also see is a slight radicalization within the Democratic Party in some of the most safe seats. I don't think it's the same level of radicalization, and that's very important to note. There is no cult of personality on the left, and they also are not against the Constitution or have threatened with violence. But the process is the same. However, the mobilization of the far right within the Republican Party is much bigger. Mm. And this goes back to the Tea Party, which is actually in many ways the wave that Donald Trump rode into particularly into the leadership.
Well, Jack, let me turn back to you. Just got a couple minutes before the next break here. So this brings me back to what the listener, Tena Cook, wrote to us on Facebook a little earlier, Tena being a registered Republican whose heart is breaking right now over the direction the party is headed. And yet Tena said, I have to stay registered as a Republican to vote in local races. I'm wondering what you thought about that, Jack.
Well, I think that's an admirable stand. And I think that is the way in which, if there's any way, if there's any cure for this Democratic, anti-democratic distemper among Republicans, that will be it, that more people like her and Liz Cheney will stand forth. Unfortunately, the polls say they're not thick on the ground. And their reforming spirit that she has is at war with the prevailing cultural pessimism of Republicans. Here's an Economist poll from February. Two-thirds of Republicans, of Trump voters, agreed with, our lives are threatened by terrorists, criminals, and illegal immigrants, and our priority should be to protect ourselves. Another poll, is public policy about enacting, policies that people want, or is it about ensuring the survival of this country as we know it? Overwhelmingly, Republicans say, politics isn't about policy. It's about ensuring our survival of the country as we know it. That's a tough situation for a reformer in the Republican Party dealing with that deep cultural pessimism.
Mm. Well, David Henry, a listener, sent us this message on Twitter, Jack, saying the GOP is no longer based on policy. Instead, it relies on personalist linkages between Trump and his followers. A listener named Ray says the Republican Party has become an existential threat to the Republic. Andy Grossman says the Republicans are headed down a scary path. If you think differently, folks, again, Twitter and Facebook, we're at On Point Radio. Let us know. We'll take a quick break and be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, it's going to be episode 2 in our series about Amazon. We're calling the series Amazon, The Prime Effect. And we're going to take a look at Jeff Bezos, founder and former CEO of Amazon, about his life and how he built the company. And we're going to do that through the story of how Amazon developed Alexa. So if you have an Alexa in your home, that smart speaker, we want to know what Alexa does for you. What's the most interesting, complicated, or strange ask you've ever made of Alexa? So give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 with your stories about Alexa or your questions about Jeff Bezos. By the way, you can also send us a recording, a voice memo of you asking Alexa questions. And then send us that voice memo via email. It's onpoint@wbur.org. That is for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about where the Republican Party is headed and by extension, where this country is headed, especially after the House Republicans, via voice vote, voted to oust Representative Liz Cheney from her House leadership position. I'm joined today by Pippa Norris, professor of comparative politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Her most recent book is called Cultural Backlash, Trump, Brexit, and Populist Authoritarianism. Cass Mudda joins us, professor of public affairs at the University of Georgia, author most recently of The Far Right Today. And Jack Beattie is with us as well. He is On Point's news analyst. Let's listen to another moment of what Representative Liz Cheney said on the floor of the House last night when she talked about, in her view, how fragile freedom is.
Mr. Speaker, I have been privileged to see firsthand how powerful and how fragile freedom is. In 1992, I sat across a table from a young mayor in Nizhny Novgorod, Russia, and I listened to him talk of his dream of liberating his nation from communism. Years later, for his dedication to the cause of freedom, Boris Nemtsov was assassinated by Vladimir Putin's thugs. In Warsaw in 1990, I listened to a young Polish woman tell me that her greatest fear was that people would forget. They would forget what it was like to live under Soviet domination, that they would forget the price of freedom.
Pippa Norris, it's quite something to hear an avowed conservative Republican talk about the Soviet Union in this particular way, because, you know, we're used to several generations of discussing the Soviet Union, the communist threat from abroad. And yet here, these are purposeful examples that Cheney is using about the, you know, the threat of the dismantling of freedom within the United States. Are they the appropriate examples, Pippa?
Well, there are many examples around the world, and Cass has mentioned Hungary. But let's emphasize that we've got in India, for example, Hindu nationalism under Modi. We have issues in the United Kingdom of Brexit, which divided bitterly the Leave and the Remainers. We have issues of abortion rights in Poland and other countries, many around the world. So what's the real problem is that you get party polarization over culture wars. In each case, the issue might be slightly different, but nevertheless, it's about moral issues where it's very difficult to compromise on reproductive rights, for example, or rights for gay marriage. On all of those issues, you have party polarization in a way that you can't compromise. And then you also have rules of the game, which are winner take all. So majoritarian systems like the United States, either you win the White House or you lose the White House. It's not like a system, for example, in Scandinavia, where there's proportional representation. And those groups who feel very strongly about these issues will get into the parliament, but always be quite small, perhaps in a coalition, but having a voice, but not necessarily dominating. And there has to be some sort of compromise to get anything done in those systems. So it's the combination of party polarization of a culture and then winner-take-all rules in America, which is the dangerous risks of liberal democracy.
Okay, so winner-take-all in the United States has brought about, I would say, a distillation of politics into a pure power game, which has been masterfully played by leading Republicans. I'm specifically thinking about Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, for example. He stands by his assertion that there's nothing wrong with American democracy right now. Listen to what he said in the Senate Rules Committee just yesterday.
The truth is quite simple. Our democracy is not in crisis, and we aren't going to let one party take over our democracy under the false pretense of saving.
Okay, so first of all, Cass Mudda, respond to that. McConnell's flipping the script here entirely and looking at the Democrats and their desire to pass a voting rights bill as taking over democracy.
Yeah, I think more than anything, what it shows is both a deep, deep cynicism and an opportunism. And a party that for a pretty long time now has not really advanced a specific agenda, but responds. It responds to the Tea Party. It responds to Obama. It responds to Trump. And I mean, the shifting is just amazing, of course, because the same McConnell has at various times said that there are all kind of things very wrong with the system. Mm-hmm. At the moment, he defends parts of the system because they work for him or because he's worried that the system will be changed. I mean, as Pippa has said, in a comparative perspective, even within, particularly within Western democracies, U.S. democracy has fundamental problems and is one of the more problematic democratic systems, irrespective of the outcome. That was also the case under Obama. Right? There are specific elements of the democratic system that are problematic. And so this statement, right, is deeply cynical.
Yeah. Well, one of the best biographies of Mitch McConnell is titled The Cynic. But, you know, there are members of the Republican Party who are saying right now that the ousting of Cheney from her leadership position is not about a denial of the truth of the integrity of American elections, but rather of preserving unity. Right? Preserving unity in the Republican Party. And I want to play another clip here of Senator McConnell himself, because all of you will recall how back in 2010, he had told the National Journal explicitly that his number one priority, his job in 2010, was to prevent the Obama administration from achieving a single policy goal. Right? In fact, he has said that once again last week, promising the same with the Biden administration.
100% of my focus is on standing up to this administration. What we have in the United States Senate is total unity from Susan Collins to Ted Cruz in opposition to what the new Biden administration is trying to do to this country.
Jack Beatty, respond to that.
Well, you know, the Republican Party is a blocking coalition. It is not a governing coalition. It doesn't even make a pretense at doing that. And that gets to what the polling shows, that GOP voters don't care about policy. Politics for them is about survival. It's about this feeling of, you know, there was a book by the historian Fritz Stern about Germany in the 20s and before, and it's called The Politics of Cultural Despair. That is rife today among Republicans, and therefore a sheerly negative force like McConnell is the embodiment of what they want. And indeed, you could argue that the attack on the Capitol, which sort of, you know, was an extreme manifestation of the anti-governmentism, that reflected in an extreme way their own views about government. It's out there in the people, in the voters. But, you know, to get back to Lindsey Graham, imagine if the leaders said something different. Imagine if the leaders said, look, if all of them had said he was legally elected, that's that. Let's go back. The attack on the Capitol was an atrocity. We can't do that again. Imagine how much that might have affected the Republican base. It wouldn't cure at all. There'd still be that anti-democratic distemper. It would matter. Leadership here has just collapsed.
You know, Senator Graham is such an interesting and I might even say disturbing example here, Jack, because do you remember after January 6th, I think a couple hours after they had finally cleared the Capitol building of the insurrectionists, Senator Graham gave a press conference where he looked genuinely frightened. He looked scared. And I clearly remember him saying, you know, he was asked of he had had a conversation with President Trump, and he was asked by reporters what he focused on next. And he said, I'm just focused on seeing if we can get through the next 14 days. Right. I mean, that was the time period between January 6th and the inauguration of President Biden. And I just thought, what is going on here? And yet that same man, now you just heard me play a clip of him saying, we can't, the party cannot grow without Donald Trump. The same man who seemingly scared Lindsey Graham down to his socks.
Yes. I mean, and this goes back to what that picture of the Republican base and the Republican primary voter and the money behind it. I mean, behind all of this is the money, dark and otherwise. And Trump has his hands on that. He has his hands certainly on grassroots contributions and the fear that if you oppose him, you'll have a primary challenge.
Well, we're getting a lot of comments again online. Justin Wilson says, I was a registered Republican in rural Kentucky, decided to change my registration to independent. I didn't realize that in Kentucky, I'm no longer allowed to vote in the primary as an independent. Oftentimes, there isn't even a Democratic candidate running at all, meaning I have lost my vote. Ryan Chambers says, this is all in preparation for 2024. If the House and Senate turn red, do you suppose there's any possibility they will allow a Democratic presidency to move forward? Pippa Norris, how would you respond to that question?
I'd like to comment also on that, but also on Jack's comment, in a sense that we often think of conspiratorial thinking and the attitudes and values of the Republican Party as deeply irrational because they're very different and they don't seem to have a rational basis. But in practice, one way of thinking about that is that essentially Republicans feel under threat because they have been under threat. In other words, social conservatism in the long term has really been on the decline in America. Think about attitudes, for example, again, towards same-sex marriage or women and men's roles in the workforce or in education or in society and attitudes towards America's role in the world. On all of these aspects, over decades now, we've seen a movement towards social liberalism, which is reflected in the mainstream media. It's reflected in much of our commentary. It's also reflected in a number of other institutions. And so social conservatives have been seeing themselves and their values, the things they think are important, things like patriotism, things like religion, things like the traditional marriage, those things they see as being under long-term threat. And they haven't managed to win the White House in the popular vote because they're a minority, but they're a large minority. Mm-hmm. We're talking about 40%. And so they feel that they can win their districts in the House, which they clearly can, and they can win the state houses very successfully, and they can win the Senate because there's a disproportionate overrepresentation of white rural America. But they can't win the White House. And so that's when they're moving to say, well, we're not going to go along with whatever the Biden administration says, even on infrastructure, which you might have thought would actually be a consensus issue. And they're certainly not going to go along with the latest ideas for electoral reform and democratic reform, because, again, it's not in their interest. So despite the fact it might look as though it's extreme and it's values which are very diverse and different to the traditional American values, nevertheless, there is a rationality behind it of being under threat and a large group who feel that their voices are not being heard. And that's what Trump's appeal is about. And as he is as much the consequence as the cause of some of these things.
But if I just may, though, point well taken. I understand that many people definitely do not feel as if they're being heard. But then to dismantle democracy, to undermine democracy, to deny the legitimacy of an election is the way to be heard?
No, it's not the way to be heard. But again, people have become frustrated by the fact that the system has been in gridlock, that they haven't had their voices heard, and that, again, over successive years, it's not simply 2016, it was well before that, we see the Republican Party has been shifting in Congress more towards conservative positions. The Democratic Party has moved somewhat less, but still towards more progressive positions on the economy and on very much on issues of, say, social diversity and pluralism. And so many people in America who feel themselves in their community to be part of a normal culture because they go to church, they speak to their neighbors, they have conservative values too, they feel they're out of touch and they're losing. And a tipping point creates the anger.
Well, so we just have about a minute and a half left here. And while, you know, while a nation is in the midst of what feels like a great tumult and transition, it has this sense of permanence. It feels like it's a permanent situation. But there are some Republicans, I'm thinking of Illinois Republican Adam Kinzinger, who supports Liz Cheney. On Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation, he basically called the Republican Party the Titanic. He said, we're in the middle of this slow sink. We have a band playing on the deck telling everybody it's fine. So he does not see this as a permanent state of the Republican Party, but rather the diminishment of the party. Cass, we've just got about 30 seconds. I'm wondering what you thought about that.
I think that history is not linear, and we have seen radicalizations in other countries and de-radicalization. And so I think the coming 4 years are very important. If the Republicans lose in 2024, the party will change fundamentally. If they win in 2024 on the Trumpian agenda, I think the country is in big trouble.
Well, Jack, we've got last 30 seconds. You get the last word today. What do you think?
Well, I see that there's a letter being put together by 100 former Republican officials basically saying we're ready to have a third party. a genuine conservative party. That is to be hoped for, I think, to split the radical Republican vote and elect a president who believes in democracy, which today might simply mean a Democratic president. Mm.
Well, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, Cass Mutta, professor of public affairs at the University of Georgia, and Pippa Norris, professor of comparative politics at Harvard's Kennedy School. Thank you to all three of you so very much for joining me today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.